right?
Well, let's look at how it would play out on the market and how that would how that dynamic would play out. And we do. The property is valued that way. Because what would happen? Vail would make an offer. It would know that, well, I'm willing to pay $11 million north of that for the opportunity to join it up with Canyons and the amount of value that would be created through that. That's how. That's why they would pay that money. They think they're going to get a rate of return that makes that a worthwhile investment for them. That's the income analysis. PCMR should be making the same rational decision and say, well, you know what? I can make $25 million if I have this property, and without it, I've got nothing. And so they should be able to actually outbid Vail if it was a rational market, because there's no question that the property is worth more to them than it would be to Vail. So the market value, if you had willing and rational buyers, would be higher than $11.4 million. And the law says to look at it as if everybody is a willing and rational buyer. That's how the market would work. And if PCMR decided not to match that offer...
Okay, but in this context, we're here in the context of an eviction, and you're saying, well, the property's worth most to them, and so we got to look at what it's worth to them, but you're in the process of kicking them off. So I mean, we've got to look outside of them, don't we?
No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is they're in possession of the property illegally. The law requires that we determine what the fair rental value would be. Let's take that it's market rate. What would the rental value of that property be on the market? The market would take into consideration how much willing buyers surrounding that property would be willing to pay. PCMR should be willing to pay, frankly, more than $11 million because of the value of that property to them. Deer Valley would pay how it values that property, and we know what Vail paid in an arm's length transaction for the way that they valued that property at $11.4 million. Now, how would the market act if it was just put out there? That's the question. We're not saying, when you look at the damages, the question is, what is the market value of this property? That's the way that they frame up the question. I think, frankly, I'd say that if you look at the Forrester standard, there's a use concept that's built into it. But let's say that it's market value, and that is, in fact, what Mr. Cook is doing. If this property was up for sale or up for rent in 2051, those parties would all compete with each other for how much they would pay for that land. The Vail transaction shows exactly, and it's a floor, of what Canyons was willing to pay for. So if anything, the market value is higher, and you also have to assume that you've got willing and rational actors.
Well, help me understand better how that $11 million figure that you keep throwing around was calculated. I mean, the problem, I guess I see your point sort of globally, that a really good indication of the value of this property is what Vail paid for it. But when we look at the Vail transaction, I can't tell what Vail paid for it. It's $25 million for a whole bunch of things. A lot of those other things are really valuable. I mean, the Canyon's base is the stuff they built over there. I mean, that's not just your average, you know, ski resort base. Canyons is a good ski resort, you know. There's a lot of assets in there. And nothing that I've seen in terms of the transaction documents try to break that out. The only things we have that break that out are the 10K. And then we have Mr. Cook coming in, hired by you guys, not by Vail. I mean, Mr. Cook's not purporting to say what Vail told him how they allocated it. Mr. Cook's purporting to do whatever he did. And so that's my hang-up is okay, I see your point that what Vail paid for it is a good indication of value, but what did Vail really pay for it?
Okay, and let me answer that directly. Let me explain to you what Mr. Cook did. Let me start, first of all, by saying that they, and we've pointed this out, they've said it's undisputed that it's more than $11 million. But let me tell you why that's a reasonable number to get to. What Mr. Cook did was, we know that the value of the whole transaction from their 10K, and yes, everything he did was from public documents and work that he did, not from any information that he got from Vail. The public disclosed amount is $344 million. It's also publicly disclosed that the projected future EBITDA from the Canyons is $15 million a year. If you look at what somebody projects that they're going to make from that property, you can then determine what portion of that $344 million would be attributed. If you took that $15 million and you did a cap to it, you get to about $166 million of what somebody looking at that, projecting that they're going to get $166 million in EBITDA, would be thinking in their heads. And then from that, you get roughly, if you take that $166 million, you apply an 8% cap rate to that, you get to roughly $13.6 million as the amount of rent that, with that $25 million a year, that's the amount of the portion that's attributable to the Canyons property. You then back out of that, you take $25 million minus the 13.6, that leaves you with 11.4. And that's the contingent interest for the value that goes to that property.
I'm looking at Mr. Cook's report, and help walk me through this. I mean, it looks like I'm at page 18, where he's trying to do a value allocation of Canyon's transaction. Is that's where you are, right? That's what you just described to me?
Well, there's a two-step process there. I need to get it, but I think what you're talking about is then after he determined the value for the Canyons, because what he was trying to do was find market comparables.
And so the problem is that you need to look at, well, what would be the lease value for the Canyons? So first he was determining what the market comparable lease component was for Canyons, which was $13.6 million. Put aside the contingent interest. Put that aside for a second. He determined, and he did a similar thing with North Star, because you can't tell immediately, well, how much of that rent payment is going towards Canyons. So he did the analysis that I just described to you, which is so this is on page 17 of his declaration. So in paragraph 29, he explains, well, I'm looking at this as a comparable to the Talisker property, but I need to figure out first how much of that $25 million is getting paid to Canyons. So he does, and this is now on page 18, he looks at the $15 million EBITDAR. He does a present value cap rate of 9%, which, by the way, is consistent with Mr. Cummings' testimony of 10 to 12 times EBITDA. He then works that back, and he comes up with that the overall accounting cost of the lease was $306 million. He then figures out how does that apply to the $25 million rent payment, and he determines that that portion is 13.6 for the Canyons. Then what he's doing, though, is saying, okay, but if you pay 13.6 for the Canyons, how much would somebody pay for PCMR?
Well, he comes up with a percentage figure here at the bottom of that table on page 18, right? He's concluding that of that $25 million, 54.41% is attributable to the Canyons.
Correct.
Am I following that?
Correct.
Therefore, 43.6 something percent would be attributable to the PCMR resort lands, according to him, right?
45.5.
Yeah, math was never my strong suit.
That's
fair enough. But whatever it is.
That's
so
correct.
Basically, a 55-45 split between Canyons and PCMR.
Correct.
And but, the way but that. For Canyons, I mean, look, I'm no accountant, but to me, that sort of fails the eyeball test. I mean, I'm interested in trying to dig a little deeper on that because, you know, if you're buying an entire integrated resort at the Canyons with the Waldorf and everything else they've got over there, and you're telling me that's only worth 54% of what they're paying, and 45% of it's worth this land over here that they really have no right to access. In order to access it, they're going to have to build a lift over Iron Mountain. They're going to have to maybe build another base over on the Bonanza side. They're going to have to get permits for this. They're going to have to do all kinds of things that they're nowhere near close to doing. And you're trying to tell me that 45% of the revenue they're paying is for that as opposed to what they've already got going turnkey. And to me, I understand the accounting principles I understand the words on the page, but to me that doesn't make a lot of sense sort of when I just look at it.
Well, I think you have to understand that PCMR is a much more profitable resort historically than Canyons. It has many more skiers.
Yeah, when it's all integrated,
yeah,
sure.
But its assemblage value, and they're looking at it from purposes of the assemblage value, and also knowing that if we're looking at this in a market, assuming that you're in a willing marketplace where you've got willing buyers and sellers all around, how much is that property worth? And you're right. that for canyons, they're going to have to pay some amount, not nearly as much as Mr. Brenwald suggests, but there's going to be some amount of building the lifts and taking investing those infrastructure costs. But what that means is that Canyons is going to have to, in a normal rational marketplace, make a bid that knows that they're going to have to make those investments to make use of the assemblage value of the land.
Can I interrupt for one second?
It's your presentation.
It's also, let me just add this rather than passing it on and having it garble. The court needs to understand, maybe the court does, but in the Vail transaction for the Canyons, it doesn't get the Waldorf. It doesn't get the development properties. It got the ski area.
And the base. And the everything that the base uses.
Not for instance, the
for the ski operations.
For the ski operations. Right. So that may have been unnecessary. I thought that it's not the whole Canyons resort.
It's not the real estate. I understand that. But
and
it's,
so
it's yeah.
But let me say, so he came at it the way that he came at it. Out of $25 million, $11 million going to the PCMR doesn't seem unreasonable. But let me say that even if it is, then that's the market. Then Vail made, then maybe they're right. Maybe Vail made a bad deal. They don't think so. But that's the market. That's what people are willing to pay
for. Well, I guess what I'm
for.
Saying is I question this allocation. I mean, they paid $25 million for the whole shooting match. I get that. But now we're sort of after the fact, 3 years later, in litigation, trying to ascertain how do you allocate that. And to me, that's, you know, the $25 million number is a market number.
And
the $11 million number is a litigation manufactured number that I'm a little bit more inherently skeptical of.
Okay, except that beyond the fact that they said it's undisputed and the purposes of their mitigation argument, the reason why Mr. Cook did three different analyses was because when you're appraising a property, you don't only rely on one data point. This was one data point. This data point points to an $11.4 million valuation. Even within the market comparables, another data point is that the very adjacent property on that same land, if you take the $4,005 an acre that they're paying, that gets you to $11.4 million. Another data point.
It's true, though, that sometimes you pay more per acre for a smaller parcel than you would for a bigger parcel. Isn't that true?
To be sure. That, you know, that's possible. And that's why you look at that. That's why you also look at North Star and do a comparable with respect to North Star. Those are ski terrain leases. And you look at those three things and they triangulate back to a similar valuation. You separately look at it from the income analysis and you look at how much the property generates and how much it could be made and you see where that takes you. And you know, because the market's going to work, that's going to be PCMR's perspective for what it's willing to pay as a willing, rational buyer. That's going to set the price. If someone's willing to pay $750,000 for your home, you know, you might think that they're overpaying for it, but that's the price you're going to sell it for. If you're the landowner, you're going to get the best price that you can get on the market. The market's going to act rationally. And just one other point on this, and then I'll move on, is that if you accept that actually more of the value belongs on Canyons, so if you don't think that it's 11.4, you think that the amount that they paid for Canyons is more than 13.6, that means that comparable is higher. And then if you're going to look at a comparable, you're looking at the ski resort right next door.
Well, I'm not looking at the Canyons comparable. I'm looking at the part of the comparable that is what they paid for this property. That's the best comparable.
That is the best comparable to look at that, but the next best comparable, so the best comparable is certainly for the subject property. The next best comparable would be to look at the piece directly south to it. And then another great comparable would be to look at the resort right next door. So if they don't even argue this, but if the suggestion is that, in fact, Canyons, they're paying more than $13.6 million to Canyons, that means that that's the comparable. That means that the market, looking at the resort right next door, is that it's $14, $15 million. Right? And so that means that's sort of a great comparable, which then that has to go back and say, well, maybe the contingent interest was greater. Maybe rather than a 15% discount, it was a 20% discount or a 25% discount. Maybe it is less than 11. But if they're paying that much for canyons, that's a great comparable that informs how you would value PCMR and the property of PCMR. So let me move on and just address the second sort of general criticism, which is the rent is unreasonable because PCMR will not be profitable if it pays. And I noticed that Mr. Sullivan picked the rent in 2014, ignoring 2012, 2013. And all Mr. Cook's doing is applying a 10%, you know, adjustment basically every year after you start at that 2012 rate. But let's take a look at that. So Mr. Connors, first of all, really does not provide any backup to explain his calculations, so we had to a little bit reverse engineer it. But first observation is that there's a disconnect between their expert Gil Miller's opinion that PCMR would lose over $15 million in profits next year if it doesn't have Talisker's land, but then to come in and say that they're only making about $6 million in profits now. There's just some disconnect between those two numbers. So something's going on there. Now, as a percentage of revenue, if you add up the rent amounts for Talisker, after the reasonable rent amount is put in there, you add in the PPI rent and you add in the other rent that would be paid, then that's 27% of PCMR's revenue. So all of their rent, including the reasonable rate, including everything else, gets you to 27% of their revenue. That at North Star, the rent amount is 27.97% of their overall revenue when you look at their rent that they're paying. At Canyons, it's 26.95% of their overall revenue. Ski resorts are able to function quite profitably with their revenues at 27%. So there's something about their numbers and their claims that they can't be profitable at these levels that just doesn't add up. Now, what we can tell is that there are three adjustments that need to be made to Mr. Connor's numbers. First of all, obviously if you run a resort more efficiently, it's going to be more profitable. He includes an 8% management fee. Off the top, 8% of revenues is just taken out. That's excessive. 5% is what Mr. Cook used in his analysis. At North Star, it's closer to 4%. So off the top, you're just taking off, before you're even looking at this, a huge amount of money that's going to the owners before you even get a profitability. If you adjust that just by itself, the resort's basically breaking even with a reasonable rent. But then they do two other things. One is they're taking depreciation of assets that they're carrying forward that they're not entitled to because the restaurants and other things, irrespective, we can debate the lifts, but all of those things are going to revert to Talisker when the lease is over. So if you're going to talk about their profitability going forward, you have to adjust to the new reality. And the new reality is they're not entitled to depreciate those assets. You can't count them. Lastly, they're frankly over-leveraged. Their interest payments are too high. Now, that can happen because when you had a below-market lease, maybe the banks were willing to use it as a different type of collateral. But you need to look at it in the new reality. And the rent payments, and Gil Miller adjusts them in his report when he projects what the future would look like and takes their interest payments down to almost about $30,000 from where they are, which is in multiple millions. So I don't know the exact number. But if you look at this claim that they won't be profitable paying 27% of their revenues in rent when all these other resorts are able to do it, and you adjust for things like management fee, you properly account for depreciation, and you recognize that they're going to have to readjust their interest payments to reflect reality, they can do quite well. The third thing, maybe I forget. So the third thing is this idea that the paying rent leads to these absurd results. The high rate of return and a high valuation on the land. Let me just say, with respect to the rate of return, Mr. Cook does not believe that the land value is $22.5 million. He never said that. That's not what he did. What he was doing, and they completely mischaracterized what he was doing with respect to the cost, he was trying to come up with an allocation percentage, a fair allocation amount for how do you decide how you attribute the amount of value that the resort produces between Talisker and between PCMR. That was the task. And in order to come up with a fair valuation percentage, he tried to, and I think it's conservative, he would just say it's right, but he tried to come up with a percentage that, you know, would make sense. And so what did he do? When he looked at the market value for the land, he wasn't valuing it as its highest and best use as improved, which you need to do. You don't just value land for its highest and best use as vacant as a standalone property. Mr. Sullivan said that as if that's a natural law or something. Actually, that's contrary to appraisal practices. That's also contrary to the law. You can't just say something like that. You're supposed to look at it as it's used for its highest and best use as improved. So he wasn't looking at it. He was essentially doing what Duray was doing, which is looking at it as if it was vacant, undeveloped ranch land. And why would you use that number? And he didn't use it for this reason, but realize that if you put in the $50,000 an acre purchase price that say the PPI lease suggests, the $4,005 an acre, that would make the land a lot more valuable in an equation of sort of balancing it, because Talisker owns much more of the land. So if you're trying to come up with a fair allocation, if you use a lower land value, you're being more generous to PCMR than if you use a different valuation. You tried to value the land as improved, taking something like the PPI lease and sticking $50,000 an acre in instead of $8,000 an acre, or the amount that that Salt Lake County values recreation land, which I understand is over $25,000 an acre. So there are other numbers that could have been used. He was trying to come up with a fair allocation formula. He wasn't going through a cost buildup analysis, and he does not offer an opinion that the fair market value of that land is $22.8 million. Similarly, with respect to the assets, he took the depreciated book value of those assets. He wasn't trying to mark those assets to market, which if you were doing a cost buildup is what you would need to do. He was just taking their own numbers of net depreciated value and which is definitely understated, and he was just plugging that in, because that's the purpose, was just coming up with what would be a fair allocation. He came up with 52% or whatever he did. But to take that and suggest that was a full cost buildup, and then to say, oh, well, the rate of return, you know, that doesn't make any sense. If you do it properly, if he's suggesting a $12 million rent and you apply a 10 capex, that suggests a $120 million valuation, just doing that. And I don't know exactly where it would come out, but he used an 8%, so maybe it's a little bit less than that. But that's essentially, if you asked him where he's implying that the purchase price value would be. Finally, this, they do this thing, they play all these games with the cap rate. They use this 5% cap rate, and it makes a big difference, because if it's a 10% cap rate, then it's essentially double. Now, Matt Ireland was deposed, and he testified that PPI used a 10% cap rate when they were valuing the PPI property after Ian Cumming purchased the land. They used a 10% cap rate. Their own expert, one of their experts, says that it's standard to have, 15 to 20% in an established, it's in his declaration, but higher numbers. If you look at the Vail 10K, it's a 10% cap rate.
Mr. Sullivan mentioned this earlier this morning, that your guy was actually using 8%, even though he said 10%. Do you know what he was referring to there?
Well, Mr. Cook did use an 8% cap rate for some of the things that he did, which is, again, a conservative assumption. When you consider that Man Ireland said that they're using 10%, that Vail's 10K says 10%, you're looking at risk. 5%, you couldn't do a deal at 5%. Nobody's going to lend you money at 5%. I mean, even Vail's corporate bonds are more than that. I mean, it's just it's not a realistic number. It's not a number that they use, and that changes everything. So then when they come in and they say, oh, well, you know, if Cook's valuing Canyon's at $166 million, if you take the PPI comparable and you apply a 5% cap rate, that insinuates a $228.5 million value, and that's just crazy. Well, actually, what's crazy is using a 5% cap rate. If you use a 10% cap rate, which reflects reality and what they themselves use, it gets to about $114 million, which is much less. I mean, you know, there's just a lot of what he's, the numbers that he's throwing around, and you have to sort of take time to parse it, but a lot of it is these games with the cap rate. And what Mr. Cook did, getting back to what he did, he used an 8% cap rate, which when you look at in the scheme of things, that's a conservative rate. Just by contrast, when Mr. Miller was doing his, he used an over 20, I think it was 20.78% rate of return to project future. Okay? Unless the court has any other questions.
Not at the moment. Thank you, Mr. Pakin. I appreciate your presentation. All right, Mr. Sullivan, Chancellor, Mr. Quinn, chance to respond to that.
Just briefly, Your Honor, because it's really hard for me to sit here all morning and not talk.
Fair enough.
What I want to do just for a minute is to bring us back into the real world. And I'm going to talk about a number of the things that both Mr. Shapiro and Mr. Pakin spoke about. The real world is now here trying to come up with a bond for maybe a 10-month period. They've asked for a bond, as you well know, no one wanted to actually say the number, a $201 million bond for a 10-year period on a piece of property that a couple of years ago was renting at $150,000 a year. It's an absurd position. Most of what Mr. Cook says, most of it, maybe not all, but most of it, when we get to a trial, a jury trial on this, we would dauber it out. We would dauber it out because it absolutely is not any methodology that any reasonable, rational real estate appraiser would use. You do not look at what the revenues or profits are of a company in order to determine how much they should pay in rent. It's absurd. It's preposterous. And anybody who's been in this business would know that. It's like I happen to be negotiating right now a new lease in our building in New York City. So far, the landlord hasn't asked for a single financial statement to try to figure out how well Weil's doing this year so we can figure out what the rent would be. That's the real world. The real world is you look at comparables and look at the comparables they came up with. They came up with one that's a related transaction. You can't possibly use a related transaction to determine anything. Number two, they come up with the North Star, which is a whole resort. It's not a piece of land. It's not a hill in the middle, undeveloped property. And then they come up with what they say is real world, what Vail negotiated with Talisker, and they have that $11.4 million number. Here's what we will show if we have to do this at a jury trial. In fact, if you look at the negotiations, what actually occurred between Mr. Bichitzer and Mr. Katz was a major discussion about the fact that what Mr. Katz was really looking for, what Vail was really looking for, at getting a hold of that land, was not simply that land to attach it to Canyons. He wanted that land because, and this would be what the testimony would be, it'd show what the documents are, he wanted the land so that he could use it to acquire PCMR and join these things together and make an enormous profit. God bless America, that's perfectly fine. But that's why, and that's the only reason why he was paying an above-market number for Canyons. And we'll debate what that number is, because the evidence would show it wasn't $11 million. That was something that this expert just pulled out of the air. So I think we have to look at what the real world is, what the real evidence will show. We're here to come up with a bond for a limited period of time, and it's certainly not anything close to $201 million. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Sullivan, anything you'd like to add?
I do want to add just a couple of things, Your Honor. Mr. Quinn said something about the motivations that Vail entered into, but I think it's important that it be really clear that Vail did overpay. This $25 million a year transaction is clearly above market because In the 10K that we have as tab 5, there is a computation that is based upon the fair market value of each of the asset categories. And Vail was required, its auditors required it to account for the fair market value of the assets that were acquired, and then to attribute as goodwill the overage, which happened to be $77 million. And so was this an above-market transaction? You bet it was an above-market transaction for all of the reasons that Mr. Quinn has mentioned. Income approach. When the problem with Mr. Cook's income approach and Mr. Pakin's description of the income approach is that you don't compute the income on a forward-looking basis of the property as part of a going concern that involves other assets that could be assembled with the property in order to generate revenues. What you look at is the property itself and what income could be generated from that property on a standalone basis. That's what appraisal is. That's what appraisal is. Now, there may be opportunities, but you have to take into consideration the limitations of the property as it sits. And what we know now about the property that is before the court, whose fair rental value we are attempting to determine as part of the bond, what we know is that this property, that Talisker, as the owner of the property, does not have the right to utilize all of the other assets of Park City Mountain Resort that are necessary to generate EBITDA that Mr. Cook uses as part of his income analysis of the property. And the other thing we know is that although Vail always says that it could use the PCMR property as part of Canyons Resort, what we know from Mr. Brenwald's declaration is that it would take $50 or $60 million in additional investment just to get a skier from the base of Canyons to the PCMR property, and then it would take an hour transit time to the PCMR property and an hour back, and it's not really a realistic solution, and it would take months and months and months of planning and permit work, and these people have done none of it. So if we're asking the question, what's the fair rental value of the property during this defined period that the court is concerned about between now and June, there is no possibility in the world that this property will be used as part of, or could be used as part of Canyons Resort. It just isn't happening. It just isn't happening. So to include any revenue that would be attributable to that, to this property for that period, is improper, and we believe it's wrong. Mitigation, the assignment of rents. Mr. Shapiro talked up here about assignment of rents, and he read some very ambiguous language about assignment of rents. What I asked the court to do is just to take a look at the highlighted language that we've pointed the court to in the 10K, where Vail indicated, in this tab 5, where Vail indicated what the assignment of rents meant to it. And it was triggered, the assignment of rents, only when Vail Talisker loses the lawsuit and the rents, the leases that are the subject of this case are extended. Prejudgment interest. Mr. Shapiro talked about what Section 15-1-1 means, but what he didn't address is that we don't have a liquidated sum here. We do not have a liquidated sum. And there is no way that you can turn Vail's, Talisker's various demands for different amounts of earnings as rent into a liquidated sum that is capable of the mathematical certainty that is required by the prejudgment interest rule. I think we'll submit it with that, Your Honor, unless the court has additional questions.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. You're getting antsy over there, Mr. Shapiro.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I apologize for that.
We'll give these guys the last word, though. So
I know. I realize that. Okay. First of all, and I don't blame Mr. Sullivan for not having heard when I addressed this, because I know I was droning on. But the Utah Supreme Court addressed the argument that you need liquidated damages before prejudgment interest applies. That's in Smith v. Fairfax, and they rejected that idea. In fact, they say explicitly it doesn't have to be liquidated damages. It just has to be calculable. And in fact, it talks about through the rules of evidence, through the rules of appraisal, as opposed to like asking a jury to put a number on pain and suffering or things like that, which is just their impression. So that's the answer to that. The 10K doesn't purport to describe the assignment of rents. It describes what happens in an adverse situation. In the event of an adverse ruling, it is correct. They would have gotten the rents that PCMR continued to pay. That doesn't go to what happens in the favorable ruling. There is some language about that too, but it doesn't purport to describe the whole assignment of rents. The bond amount, as I think the court is aware, that we're seeking is not $201 million, it's $123.9 million. Second, because the court obviously expressed some concern about the value, the 11.4 derivation, and I get that, but let me just say, the 13.6 is not just a number picked out of thin air. What Mr. Cook did is look at the Canyon's EBITDA projection, which was in the 8K at the time of the purchase, of $15 million. He applied a capitalization rate of 9%, and he explains in the footnote why here it was more appropriate to use 9 than 10, and he gets to $166 million. Had he used 10, he would have got to 150. He gets to $667 million. And then all he does is take that as what percentage of the total value of the transaction is and come up with the 54.
Yeah, and I guess to articulate better my hang-up, I guess I don't think it necessarily follows that the entire rest of the transaction is the value of the resort lands, right? I mean, we've got intangibles, we've got synergies, we've got these words that people who do corporate deals like this throw around, and it's always over my head. But it doesn't necessarily follow. I mean, they booked $77 million worth of goodwill, right? And so, yeah, you know, I don't know that it follows that if 13.6 million of the 25 million goes to Canyons, it necessarily follows that the remainder all goes to the resort lands. Does it?
Every last penny, I think I couldn't make that argument to you because 77 million of goodwill, which is booked, by the way, that's actual value. Just because, you know, we shouldn't act like, you know, we could set that aside when we're, which is why they're not using just the $54 million and then a.
Right, but that means that that value doesn't necessarily come from Canyons or from the resort lands. It comes from maybe the fact that this particular purchaser bought the land and is able to combine the two and create something greater than the sum of its parts.
But the 10K, excuse me for interrupting, 10K says it primarily derives from the ability, the whole, I mean, it's some of the litigation discount, right, is to be able to add that into the lease. That's what some of the, that intangible is, and in fact, the 10K says that's primarily. So again, is it every last penny? You know, might you come out at 11 instead of 11.4, 11 and 14? But the idea that we're way off that, I don't understand. And frankly, what we are trying to do here is value what it has been worth to PCMR over these years they've remained in unlawful occupancy, right? And as Forrester talks about the value of the use and occupancy of the premises, that's the Utah Supreme Court. It's been worth a lot to them. In fact, they claim that the loss of it would cost them $16 million. So that, when we're looking backwards, and for as long as they're permitted to remain on the land, it is in combination with them that we're assessing. More broadly in fair market value, absolutely right. It's in terms of an arm's length transaction, and as to that, again, we can argue about what exactly that number is, but it is some substantial component of that 25. Our expert says it should be roughly 11.4. Thank you.
Mr. Sullivan, last word's yours.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. That's not what Forrester says. I agree that what Mr. Shapiro is trying to do is to have the court determine the amount of rent based upon the amount of money that a particular user of the property,
PCMR can make from a business that includes the property at issue. But that's not what rent is. And that's not what the test in an unlawful detainer case is. And if you look at the Forrester case, it's kind of a complicated case. But I like to boil it down to page, this is tab 7, page 5. It's interesting, the Supreme Court was reviewing the record and the transcript. And if you read through the whole thing, what the Supreme Court says is that the trial judge asked the right question of the real estate appraiser who was called upon to give a fair rental value determination. And the question that the trial judge asked in the top of the second column on page 5 is, what would you be willing, we will put that in, put it that way, what rent would you be willing to pay for this apartment house? What rent would you be willing to pay? And then down to the bottom of the page, the Supreme Court says the true measure of damages would be the rental value or the reasonable value of the use and occupancy of the premises as a whole, and that would necessarily be less than the sum of the rent value of each of the several apartments. And next, the court says at the bottom of page 5, the damages which may be recovered in an action such as this one, an unlawful detainer case, are measured by the rule that they must be the natural and proximate consequence of the acts complained of and nothing more. And what the court says there is that what the landlord lost was rent. So you need to determine what a fair rental value is. And that is consistent with the Monroe case, and that is consistent with the other cases that we've cited to the court. Another topic. Mr. Shapiro and Mr. Pakin have said that Mr. Cook did not make a determination of the fair market value of the land, the 3,000 acres that we're talking about here. I disagree. I am looking at pages 6 and 7 of his report, paragraph 10, and he begins paragraph 10 by saying, for these purposes, I valued the land as though vacant and available for development to its highest and best use. And then he has Schedule C1, land value allocation, and he has the land owned by GPCC valued at $8,000 an acre, and he has Talisker's lands, which could only be the 3,000 acres that we're talking about here, and he comes up with a value of $22,816,000. So the idea that he did not do an appraisal of the land in question is belied by his own report. The other data point that we have on this
He's using the cost approach there, isn't he?
He is. But in order to reach the cost approach, he sees he valued the land as though vacant and available for development on its highest and best use. That was his purpose in doing that. The other data point we have on that is the $57.8 million that appears in the 10K that Vail filed with the SEC in 2013, $57.8 million. Again, the purpose of valuing those assets was to determine what the fair value of each of the components of what Vail got for his $344 million would be, and the overage they recorded as goodwill. And so they needed to do the fair value of the property, the 3,000 acres, plus all improvements on the property, and they valued it at $57.8 million. So we think those are important data points for the court to have. I just have to say one word finally about Mr. Pakin's analysis of Mr. Connor's conclusions that PCMR would lose money every year. Mr. Pakin didn't have to guess about any of this stuff. We have provided counsel with all of the documents that Mr. Connors used. His statement that 8% is an excessive management fee, there is no support for that. I mean, Mr. Cook says that as well in a single sentence with no analysis. He's not an expert on managing a ski resort. And the bottom line is Mr. Pakin's analysis is that, gee, the rent that we are claiming is only 27% of revenue overall, total gross revenue. And that's not all that bad. 2 points. One, point number one is that it's 50 or 60% of earnings, of EBITDA. And who's to say that that's the fair rental value? I mean, who says that that is a fair rental value when the question is not how much PCMR can pay in rent and squeak by or lose money. The question is what a willing buyer, a willing lessee of this property, standing alone, looking at all of its limitations, would pay as rent for this property. And we know the answer to that. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan.
Your Honor, not to rebut, but and I don't know where we are procedurally, but we're done before the court rules, and that's why I was presenting tonight. We think it might be useful to update you on development since we spoke this morning.
All right, before we, and okay, fair enough, so we'll go back and chat about that. But first, let me make sure we make a record on this. There's been a lot of proffer today. There's been some proffer by Mr. Shapiro and Mr. Paikin about what Mr. Cook would say if he were sworn in and were to testify. There's been some proffer with regard to Mr. Doré and the other experts from the plaintiff side. I think I'm okay with the proffers and the reports that I've reviewed, but I just want to make sure we make a record that none of you are asking for limited cross-examination or something like that. I know I can see that some of these experts are here. Does anyone want to have some limited cross-examination on some very points that may be relevant? I mean, I don't want necessarily to be here the rest of the day, but I want to make sure you've had a chance to at least voice your concerns there. Mr. Sullivan?
Unless they want to cross-examine our witnesses, then I'll cross-examine their witnesses. But I think the court's fully advised now.
Mr. Shapiro?
We're fine with that. Thank you.
Okay. I would like a few minutes to gather my thoughts, go over my notes, look at the new things that were handed up today by Mr. Sullivan. So I was going to take a break for a few minutes. I don't know if you want to make it a full lunch break or not. And now that you say that there's some updates you want to give me, perhaps we ought to take at least a 20-minute or so break, have you come back and tell me what you want to tell me, and then give me a few minutes to gather my thoughts together, and we'll come back out and make a ruling. Or we could break for lunch. Anyone have any preferences?
Yeah, I think 20 minutes is fine for us, yeah.
Okay, well, let's take a 20-minute break, and we'll see counsel in chambers just for a couple minutes. We'll be back out maybe 12:30, a little bit after. Hopefully, I'll be prepared at that point to make a ruling.
All rise.